and that created no substantial changes. And I believe that in those 20 years that we have seen some voids, those of us who are working in the fire service with police departments enforcing these laws, one of the voids is seen in the first section of the proposed changes, and that refers to the danger to firefighters and police officers. This was not intended to frivolously recommend that if a police officer trips and sprains his ankle while he's standing around directing traffic at a fire scene, that this elevate the crime to an arson one. This is a very real factor that firefighters and police officers deal with every day. Fires are set sometimes in buildings which would not qualify for arson one, and very often do result in injuries to firefighters. In some cases, and I have personal experience with this, firefighters are subjected to dangers that are intentionally placed there by the arsonist, knowing the vagaries of the law. I had occasion several years ago to interview after the fact, actually 3 years after the fact, to interview an arsonist who set fire to a, I believe it was a Dairy Queen structure after normal operating hours. He set the fire in such a way as to intentionally place the firefighters in danger. He used a propane bottle and he attempted to kill firefighters. He was unsuccessful, but that was his intent. He was prosecuted, but he was prosecuted for a Class C felony. If this happened tomorrow after this bill is enacted, then he would be properly prosecuted under as a Class A felony because of the danger to the life of the firefighters and his intent to cause those firefighters harm.
Thank you very much. Jerry Gould and Larry Lohr, and then we do have to get on to some other bills. Representative Clark. Okay.
My name is Jerry Gould, and I'm a claims investigation specialist for Farmers Insurance in Portland, Oregon. And I work daily with these people as a part of my job. I don't want to elaborate other than the fact that the insurance industry supports this 100%. We feel it's time for some upgrading and some housekeeping on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Larry Lohr.
Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Larry Lohr. I'm here representing the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Investigation Section. I'm the chief officer of that section and have six investigators working within that section. I'm also representing as an executive board member the Oregon Fire Marshals Association. It's made up of fire marshals throughout the state of Oregon. We're in strong support of this House bill because it brings up and clarifies a couple points that have needed clarification for a long time. Within our jurisdiction, we have two major institutions. However you want to define that, we cover Damish State Hospital and Cedar Hills Hospital. I can give you statistical information, although I want to just recap it. Since January 1st of 1990, we've had 11 fires within the institution of Damish, and the majority of those fires are, that go past that were not reported, and it's for one reason. Although there is a lot of discussion about the clarification of arson of first degree, we are not able to get first degree arson charges in a cement building when somebody uses the weapon of fire to destroy what another person has in their whole possession, which is a 2 by.
He also might have some problems in damage with the intent.
Actually, we haven't had. We have people that are committed there because they have fire setting tendencies and they burn things like old cars, dumpsters, and they have a record of these things, but because it is so small a crime, we're having difficulty getting them through the system so that the record doesn't exist. So we end up through multi-agency phone calling saying, have you heard of this person? We're having a problem, and we find them committed in damage, and we have two or three fires from them. and we try to get him back into the system is that this person is going to cause a problem. And the difficulty we have is just because we're confining them in a building that is built to resist fire through fire sprinklers, through concrete construction, does not mean that when we let these people back out into the society that they will continue to find concrete structures to burn. And that's some of the difficulties we have. In Cedar Hills, we have the patients that go to the extent after they've already lit fires to escape the facility. And once they have already been put into a lockup of some sort, they will hide within their body cavities lighters so that they can continue to burn their way out of these institutions. And although it may be very clear to some people, the actuality is that we are not successful in getting first-degree arson charges on anybody in those institutions. It doesn't happen. That's why we're in strong support of the institutions. If it's not worth losing the entire bill, I think the bill has other functions in it that would prove equally beneficial. One of the things that I'd like to speak to is the firefighter and police officer issued damaged or injured in the line of duty. I think we should remember that although fire was a long time ago used as a weapon, currently it's used in a weapon in facilities that are built much differently today. Our construction industry is looking at ways that they can build buildings lighter framed, less expensively, and fire travels through them faster and creates danger to the firefighters that didn't exist 10 years ago. And that is why I think that that is a more important issue of today than it was in 1979 when I believe Senator Cohn, you mentioned they were entirely reworked. Things have changed quite a bit. In terms of the criminal mischief, we believe that the starting of a fire is used as a weapon just as much as an explosive device. Somebody that uses an explosive device or uses a Molotov cocktail have the same intent, same purpose in mind. And those injuries are going to be just as severe and the action is just as rapid in its problems. And last but not least, the aggravated criminal mischief would allow for those things which currently we have, as you heard testimony before, we have a lot of car fires. And right now I'm in a policy decision as to whether or not we take people out into the field to investigate any car fires, given that whether it be the $500 Chevy Nova or be a brand new Beamer makes no difference. And the caseload that the district attorney's offices are faced with, they just don't have the time to hear some of those cases, unfortunately. We believe that if we can look at the elevation to criminal mischief when the value exceeds $10,000, that we're going to have more success in drawing attention to those cases. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Senator Hill.
Yes, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask one question. This is in the area of where the fire is set in, and it's a class automatically Class A felony when a firefighter or a peace officer is injured. If I'm trying to think of a situation where I may even stupidly start a fire on some property, maybe it's some abandoned property or something, and I start a fire with my intention, and it gets out of hand, and I will maybe even call you. And you come to put out the fire, and you get hurt. Now, it seems to me that I'm a different person than somebody who is just doing the Dairy Queen thing that you mentioned, or intentionally trying to just start fires, because I did intentionally start the fire, but it got out of hand, and then I needed help. And it seems to me that I could be subject to a Class A felony, and I'm not saying I shouldn't be subject to something, because it's pretty stupid, maybe, but how do you differentiate that situation from, you know, the real, I guess, the situation you're really getting at here?
The way we differentiate that is the way we do currently, is that we have to show the culpable mental state that a person was intentionally creating that as a damage, as a weapon. So if your intent was to start a fire for cooking purposes inside of your barn, that your intent wasn't to create the, cause the fire to should go onto the barn.
Well, let's say, for example, now I own a, I'm thinking of a rural area, and I just, I have an old dilapidated structure that I probably should just have them, but I decide that I'm going to set fire to it instead, and it's on my property, and it gets out of hand, or someone else calls you, the fire people, and you come. I've intentionally done that, but I haven't done it to hurt you and I, or anyone else. And as I say, maybe it's an unwise act, but I'm not a malicious person who's trying to use something as a weapon as you mention it.
And I think that I have this sheet is full of all of the firefighter injuries from January of 1990. I think it's important to note that although on the Willamette Industries fire there were 9 injuries to firefighters, none of the injuries in this report would be ones that we would be applying this law to. What we're looking at is that these 9 injuries should point out to us that just as quickly as an accidental case caught fire and hurt 9 people, if it was an incendiary fire, in other words, it was caused and recklessly done. It was of a reckless act. Recklessly endangered those people. That's what we're trying to get to. Not there are fires, sir, I can tell you that virtually all fires that we go to, after we get done talking about the fire with the people, they say, boy, that was sure stupid. Mm. Those people are not charged with a crime. Their intent was not to commit a crime. This law does not say that they committed a crime. It simply says if it was their intent to commit a crime, that we're going to say that they committed a crime to the fullest if they injure a firefighter or a police officer. If their intention was to cause the action in the first place, which was a crime, then we want that to go to the fullest extent. And not, we've done it in the laws for the police dogs. We raised it to the highest that was available on the criminal, I believe it's criminal mischief on the canines. We're saying that an injury to a police officer or a firefighter because somebody intentionally and recklessly caused a fire, that we want that person whose intent was a criminal action in the first place to be held to the highest regard of the law.
You know, and I see what you're getting at, and I really understand it, but it's there's something here. I guess we'll deal with it, Madam Chair. I think there's a difference between someone who really sets something and somebody who is really reckless versus intentional. I guess this is just bothers me just a little bit with what you're saying. Because I don't, as most of the time I do believe these things get out of hand, but it may have been a real stupid intentional act that got the fire started in the first place.
I understand your statement, and I agree, and I don't believe that is our intention.
Okay.
We're looking at trying to, again, go back to the people that have the intention to cause us damage.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Senator Brockman.
Just one thing. You kind of lost me on the old lighter fluid under the door in the dorm trick, some time ago,
prosecute that one too.
Is it? Yeah. Well, not till it becomes statute.
On arson, one. We hope.
Some time ago, last year, I believe, there was a derelict in an alley in Klamath Falls that started a fire for warmth. Ended up burning down virtually the entire building, 3 or 4 shops. If this reaches the lighter fluid under the door in the dorm, what happens to that guy? I don't remember the resolve of that case. He was an indigent, and I think they fined him some horrendous amount of money that he obviously had no way of ever repaying. I don't know if you recall that or not. But
I'm sorry, that's not my jurisdiction, although I can only speak that the incidents that the committee is bringing forward are acts of accidental nature,
mm-hmm.
with no real intention. This law doesn't speak, what we're talking about has no relevance to to those issues.
So that guy's not going away for life under this bill?
No.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Representative Clark is here on a couple of bills. They are work session bills. Let's go ahead. Did you have more questions? Are we ready on that one first? Kelly, whichever one you want to talk about first. We've got the House Bill 4438, pilot program. We've got peyote, 3039. And anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I think that's all for tonight. If I could, just in brief on House Bill 3438, I think Jim Seymour is here, and he can present you with the nuts and bolts exactly of kind of what has been worked out as proposed amendments, and that would be between the proponents of the bill and I think largely the Association of State, County, Municipal Employees, who had some concerns about the bills. But briefly, the direction that those amendments go are this. Collective bargaining groups would like to see the juvenile parole officers and caseworkers added to the Juvenile Justice Council. And that is the statewide group that is charged with monitoring the success of this pilot project. That's one addition that we would suggest. Secondly, in the portion of the bill describing the Juvenile Justice Council's duties, we propose that you would add those same two individuals, a juvenile parole officer and a caseworker, CSD caseworker, as the Juvenile Justice Council does its duties. We'd like to strengthen the council's role in the evaluation of the pilot program. And then, finally, there's been some question about whether the bill, as it's proposed to you, would require the violation of some existing collective bargaining agreements. And because certain of the members of AFSCME have exclusive rights to do juvenile parole work. And rather than ask anyone to give up anything that they have bargained for in the collective bargaining process, we would propose that the existing collective bargaining agreements can stay and should be followed, with some provision that management and labor shall work in good faith to allow the implementation of the purposes of this act. Representative Bryan and I have complete confidence in Mr. Tibbetts and Mary Botkin and AFSCME and their membership. Without asking them to give anything up from the collective bargaining process, we're confident that they will work in good faith to make sure that this is a genuine pilot project and experiment. And I said to Cecil Tibbetts with a wink, we may be back in 2 years doing battle, but let's not do battle in 2 years until we know if the pilot project is going to work. And I have confidence that they will do their best to make sure that that's going to work without having to renegotiate the collective bargaining agreements. So with those three sort of conceptual amendments, to which I think Mr. Seymour has some language for you, that'd be my comments on 3438.
Great, thank you.
Senator Hill. Yes, Kelly, I may have missed it. Did you mention anything about the independent evaluation?
The only thing that I know along the discussion about the evaluation, Senator, is that there's been some discussion about strengthening the Juvenile Justice Council's role in evaluating the pilot program, and that whether or not that constitutes that independent evaluation or not, I'm not sure.
We do have amendments A5, which came to us, which were offered by their AFSCME group, and I guess
the only
probably still here. We have a note, I think.
Madam Chair, I think the idea of strengthening the Juvenile Justice Council's role to include evaluation of the pilot project was meant as a substitution for that, as an attempt
because
to get
of the cost.
Because of the potential cost of it.
Okay, that's important to have that.
I'm willing to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think that was the reason for bringing the council into the evaluation.
And process. I would suggest that hopefully we that they would continue with going out to see if they can get some grant money
to
fund evaluations for this purpose and to that end, hire an independent contractor to do that. We need to follow up on that as we move forward.
I know that there's a plan to go out for some private grant money, and it makes a lot of sense to have that include the evaluation stage as well. So, Madam Chair, unless there are any other comments, that's all I have to say on 3438 for right now.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, we'll get back to that. Why don't you go ahead on 3039?
Great.
And we'll come right back to 38 when we get on to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3039 came out of the House with a vote of 40-16, and I believe it came out of House Judiciary for information with a vote of 10-2. And Representative Edmondson could not be here tonight, but asked me to express his strong support for the bill. He is the other chief co-sponsor. And with us tonight is Mr. Smith, who was the subject of the twice considered U.S. Supreme Court decision. And he has quite a story to tell, and I would recommend his testimony to you. Let me give you just a few comments by way of introduction. The bill is really in some ways not required by, but is a response to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Employment Division versus Smith. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution requires, under certain circumstances, the Free Exercise Clause requires that government makes exceptions for religious practices that might conflict with neutral laws. Historically, the Supreme Court has said that exceptions were not required for religious practices only if the government could show a, quote, compelling state interest in causing someone to forego a religious belief or a religious practice. This principle came to be known as the doctrine of religious accommodation, and it had been spelled out through a series of cases over about 40 years. Just a couple of examples of this that you probably are familiar with. In the 40s, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the government had no compelling interest to force Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the flag, since that practice violated their religious beliefs. In 63, the court said that the First Amendment prohibited states from denying unemployment benefits to persons who lost their jobs because of Sabbath day observance. The court supplied the principle in deciding that the Old Order Amish could withdraw their children from compulsory high school in Wisconsin after age 16, that Jewish religious schools could not be barred from interscholastic competition simply because their students wear head coverings, and et cetera, et cetera. However, and everyone, when the Smith case went up to the Supreme Court, everyone considered that this would be the analysis that the Supreme Court would use in deciding the Smith case. However, with no prior hint that they were going to abandon that analysis, they completely threw out the accommodation doctrine in the Smith case. And quoting from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, "The court today dramatically departs from well-settled First Amendment jurisprudence in a way totally unnecessary to resolve the question presented and in a way totally incompatible with our nation's fundamental commitment to individual religious liberty." Already, because of this decision, it is the worst religious liberty decision I've ever read, without a doubt, the worst U.S. Supreme Court decision I've ever read on First Amendment issues. Just in a few months since the Smith case was decided, or perhaps about a year now, around the country, various courts have held that medical autopsies can be performed on individuals against their religious beliefs and over the objections of their families, despite there being no compelling state interest to perform the autopsy. Two cases, one against a Laotian immigrant Hmong family, and second against a Jewish mother. Hmongs view autopsies as mutilations, and Judaism prohibits autopsies. And two courts just steamrolled those religious liberty objections in light of Smith v. Employment Division, said the accommodation doctrine no longer has any strength. Members of the Sikh religion who wear turbans no longer receive an exemption from federal regulation requiring construction workers to wear hard hats. U.S. Constitution no longer mandates that Amish buggy drivers have the right to substitute reflective tape and lanterns for the fluorescent orange triangles, even though they offered an alternative more protective of traffic safety. Muslim prisoners can no longer ask for substitute meals containing pork when they're in prison. These are just a few of the decisions that have been handed down, citing Employment Division v. Smith. And so, in some ways, because these cases arose from Oregon, certainly the legal scholarship community is watching what Oregon's response will be. And House Bill 3039 is an attempt to at least say, from Oregon's perspective, we're not going to have that. We are not going to stand for that in Oregon. The bill is very carefully drafted to say that religious use of peyote is an affirmative defense to prosecution under the controlled substances statutes. It is not an outright exemption. We considered that an outright legalization of peyote for religious use, but decided largely, quite frankly, in order to calm some of the concerns of the law enforcement community, we decided to make it an affirmative defense to prosecution. And if you look at the bill, it's even that is very carefully drafted. You have to show that the use is in connection with the good faith practice of a religious belief. It is directly associated with that religious practice, and it is being done in a manner not dangerous to the health of the user or others in proximity. That latter provision being a safety to make sure that that children, for example, or others in the proximity of the user are not put in any danger. And so we've crafted the bill as narrowly as possible, and yet hopefully by the passage of the bill we'll send a message to the law enforcement community, certainly, but also I think to the U.S. Supreme Court that we think that this is that the U.S. the decision that the court gave is outrageous, and that in Oregon we are going to protect religious liberty to the extent we can by providing that we're not going to be prosecuting people who use peyote in a religious context. One of the things that you do in a war, and if we're in a war on drugs, I suppose the analogy is appropriate, one of the things you do is you make sure you don't kill innocent civilians who are not aiding and abetting the enemy. And as I think the testimony from Mr. Smith will show, there is it is a fairly long leap to conclude that the use of religious use of peyote is in any way a use of a narcotic drug in the traditional sense of that, in the traditional sense in which our society views that as a problem. It is much more akin, I would suggest, to sacramental use of wine or some other sacraments in Western religions. And seems to me to leave as criminal the religious use of peyote is akin to trying to criminalize the sacramental use of wine. So with that, Madam Chair, the only other thing I would comment on is we received no testimony, and I am convinced you will receive no compelling testimony that the use of peyote is in any way dangerous. And Mr. Smith's testimony, I think, will shed some light on the way in which peyote is used. And I don't want to steal his thunder because he states his story and the need and the case for an exemption far more compellingly than I can.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can I have a question? Thank you very much, Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alfred Leo Smith, and I'm here because of the thunder that my going to church caused. I ask you to pass this bill for the people. I'm a native of this state of Oregon. My people have been here from the beginning of time. I'm very proud native of this state, proud of the people. I never thought that my going to church would go to the United States Supreme Court. And I never dreamed that we would be disallowed to practice our religion. How long they've been practicing, Native people have been practicing a method of prayer to the Creator is their understanding. The Creator only knows. What got me here, I'm 71 years old. I became an alcoholic from the first time I drank alcohol. And my recollection is the first time I drank alcohol was when I was 9 years old, and I became drunk. I drank as an alcoholic up until the age of 37. When I was 37 years old, I ran out of gas. And I attended Alcoholics Anonymous. I relapsed. And I, 3 months later, I woke up under a set of stairs in Sacramento, California, Skid Row. And there I had a moment of clarification. If I continue to drink alcohol, I would certainly die. I knew that. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, January the 15th, 1957. I've been sober ever since. I was counting how long it was coming up here from Eugene. 34 years and 5 months it'll be. I certainly know where I came from.
Which I read to say that they'll may be maintained in effect, except that management and labor will negotiate as necessary for purposes of developing the pilot programs. My first concern would be who's management, and at what point will those negotiations take place with respect to the pilot project? My sense would be management in that context would have to be the counties that are selected by CSD as potential pilot programs. In any event, whatever negotiations take place would have to be completed before a county enters into a pilot program, because apart from that, the county wouldn't know what it's getting into or whether it's even workable.
Clearly, I think that's necessary. You couldn't embark on that road unless you had an agreement that had been modified or provided for that particular county effort. So I guess what you're asking for is some further iteration to the words with respect that have been offered by Mary Botkin that deal with timelines and expectations.
I think, Madam Chair, perhaps something that would say that the modifications would be agreed upon before the pilot projects are entered into and approved by the counties that are the pilot project.
Okay, well, I think we ought to send them away with amendments in concept form that will go to work, and so that we can move forward to adopt the A3 amendments and then move toward further modifications of the A5 amendments to see where we get to a final checkoff on Wednesday. That's okay with you. I think it's important that we try to get this put together.
Well, I think it's fine. I mean, obviously, this is something. It's unfortunate that that the representatives from the public employees unions aren't here. But if we are talking about trying to put this together, and we're going to come back on Wednesday, and I think that that's about the best. Maybe I think it's the wisest thing.
Yeah, I want for sure to give Ingrid some. It's useful to have people here to sort of say, this is what we think needs to be, you know, Paul's input is important, and we need to go back and talk about adding that kind of language to the dash five as well, in terms of explicitly understanding these agreements are sort of worked out before you embark on a pilot project for some 4 years, and
not be stuck in the middle if something falls apart.
Marcia, I guess we can, move, these
well,
things conceptually, with, I guess that this one thing outstanding, I would guess, because as I understood, there was an agreement on just about all of this here, and now there's a party here that, as I understand, didn't know anything about it. So I think it would be good to move it, and then we'll have them get together as soon as possible, maybe accept this conceptual, and hope that that will do it.
Okay, do we have an, do you have a clear understanding of where what the discussion has been here in terms of modifications, requests?
I think that, you know, the dilemma that we're in is there are those who would like it to be clear and mandatory that AFSCME negotiate in a way that would allow probation officers and county juvenile departments to do parole work. Currently, their contract would exclude that. And their position is they don't want to give that piece away at this time, but they have made a commitment that in the specific counties that do pilots, that they will work with us and their people to make the pilots possible and to work. And so it, I think you're left taking something again on good faith and trust.
Well,
and in the end, that's
what
we have to work.
Because we're going to say you have to put, there's a deadline, folks, if you're going to sign up as a county and sign up as a group to make this work, then you have to work out the agreement before the money starts flowing, the whole, before the project starts. I think that's what we're saying. If I think that's what Paul said.
If we were not able to negotiate with AFSCME an exclusion in the counties that want to participate, those 3 to 6 counties that participate in the pilots that allow probation staff to do parole work, if we were not able to work that out, then I think that would probably prohibit most counties from wanting to participate. And so what we're saying now is we're not going to require that in the bill, but we are going to expect that in a good faith effort to work that out afterwards. And I think a lot of this in the final analysis is going to have to be worked out in good faith anyway. We have a commitment from Mr. Tibbetts that we will work that through.
I'm sorry. The language that's being offered here doesn't say that. And you need to look at that language and you need to think about adding the language that Paul just offered. Because that's basically what might be considered here. So I think that
Madam Chair, Paul Snyder, I'm anxious for this to work. And I know we're very, very short on time. I'm concerned, though, that if the committee adopts amendments conceptually today, if you can just wait till Wednesday, we can get together with the different parties and get something together that looks like it's likely to work.
Back to us then.
We will. And work very hard on it between now and Wednesday. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's 2203.
All right.
Ingrid, the definition of money.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, This is a Department of Corrections bill which would include money in the institutions as a form of contraband without regard to whether it created some danger, which is the current law. John Foote testified in favor of the bill, And the committee's concern at the time was that if the terminology used was money, it could include money in accounts and need not be currency, which is what the department wished to have included in its definition. I did work with John Foote and Virginia Vanderbilt to try and recraft the language so that it more narrowly described actual currency inside the institution as the contraband that was being prohibited. So you have dash A3 amendments and a hand-engrossed copy of the bill, which would substitute for the word money, currency, and then define currency as paper money and coin within the correctional institution.
Okay. Problems with the amendments?
No, I just a question. It's my lack of knowledge of this. Someone who is confined can't have a $5 bill in his pocket. I mean, that's it. It's all in an account somewhere that can be drawn upon for something. You can't carry money in it if you're a prisoner. I mean, I don't know. Pardon me for not knowing that, but I don't.
Madam Chair, Senator Bruckman, the testimony was that money can too easily be used to purchase illegal goods.
Well, I'm not talking about the motive, but I mean, can you walk around with a pocket full of dollar bills?
It was their desire to do that, but the language does not in itself prohibit it, because it has been construed to require that the contraband has to also be dangerous. In the use that's made of it. The court has construed, so consequently controlled substances are not contraband. And that's why they've asked for this bill, because these items in and of themselves are not contraband by virtue of the court decision unless they are also dangerous in terms of the use that was made of them in the institution.
But the rules in the institution currently, rules, not statute.
Mm-hmm.
Rules in the institution in the past have said you shouldn't.
That's correct.
You shouldn't carry money around with you.
That's correct.
Okay, so they were trying to get them a statute.
I mean, is that a rule for my personal safety, or is that a rule for that I might buy something illicit with it or something? I mean, I don't. I'm at a loss on this, and I was here when we had the testimony the other day, but I don't understand whether, if I am a convict down the road here, whether I'm able to carry money or...
They don't want you to carry money.
Well, I wouldn't probably want to, but depending on what I wanted to buy. But money in and of itself is not contraband, I don't think, unless it was gained from some illicit deal.
This bill would like.
I mean, we're going to create it. That it is. That's what we're driving at.
Make it contraband.
Okay.
I guess the other question I would ask for Ingrid and whoever, just to be reassured, if they buy from the canteen, there's no money that changes hands.
It goes out of the account.
It goes out to the account. So there isn't any legitimate reason.
Madam Chair, and that was the reason we used the word currency instead of money, because money might be construed to mean money in an account, and this means actual dollars and cents, coins, and paper money.
Okay. What's the pleasure of the committee with this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I will go ahead then and move the dash A3 amendments.
Senator Hale moves the dash A3 amendments. Discussion, objections. Hearing none, so
ordered.
Okay. We have the bill.
Mr. Madam Chair, I will move House Bill 2203 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Hale moves House Bill 2203 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
I guess.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Well, the DA in the audience says, my God, it's like pulling teeth to get him to figure a little contraband here.
Senator Brockman carried the bill.
Right.
Yeah. I can guarantee
it's tough on crime bill.
I can guarantee its success if I carry it, yeah.
Okay. House
you want to write my carrying speech if they really stick it with me?
2264. They came here expecting to get bigger things out of this committee. 2264. Ingrid.
Madam Chair, this bill was introduced at the request of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. It corrects, it's principally addressed at correcting a problem which arose from legislation last session, which I believe people understood was an effort to permit juveniles a sort of means of, to provide juveniles a means of diverting them in cases of the possession or delivery of small amounts of marijuana. However, the legislation from last session inadvertently included all drug offenses and basically permitted juveniles who participated in these programs to seek dismissal of charges regardless of their record and regardless of the nature of the charges. So the bill does that. It limits the ability of the court to grant diversion to circumstances involving possession of less than an ounce of marijuana or delivery for no consideration of less than 5 grams. It does a couple of other things. For children who are eligible to participate in the program, the bill provides that if the parents aren't able to pay, that this fund, the Intoxicated Driver and Marijuana Possession Fund, could pay for that treatment. It gives the court discretion to determine which juveniles are appropriate to participate in this program. And it also requires that in cases of informal disposition, where the child has not been adjudicated on the charges, a similar kind of diversion program is required for informal disposition of cases involving allegations of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana or delivery for no consideration of less than 5 ounces. And the A2 amendments, Madam Chair, are conflict amendments. This committee had passed House Bill 3112, which contained language contrary to the language in this bill. When this bill referred to the Office of Alcohol and Drug Programs, and the other bill referred to the Assistant Director. That was the preferred language. So
okay.
This is being amended to conform.
There are objections to the A2 amendments.
Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. Pleasure on this bill, folks.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2264 as amended.
Okay,
there's a lot of enthusiasm around
here. Well, it's late. Unfortunately and misfortunately, we spent a lot of time on it. And it would have been my preference that we'd had a work session first and then dealt with the other bills. But Senator Hill moves House Bill 2264 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Hey, you want to do the peyote bill?
Sure.
Senator Brockman?
Oh, you see, I've been doing cartwheels down here all night about these bills. I'll support it. What the heck? I'll even move it.
Okay, Senator Brockman moves House Bill 3039 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's take 2018. See how we feel about that one. This is the there may be some reservations, Springer had reservations about this, but this is the assault by more than one person. And you have to have intention, right, Ingrid?
Madam Chair, it would be either intentional or knowing conduct that causes physical injury to another person, and let's see if I can make it a Class C felony.
Are there any amendments to this bill?
I think not. We have amendments? I don't think we
no,
have
Madam Chair.
Then I'll move House Bill 2018 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brockman moves House Bill 2018 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
I'll probably vote for it. I'm a little bit uncomfortable that it doesn't have the serious injury requirement that several of the other Class C felony assaults have. It doesn't have the deadly or dangerous weapon that those that don't have serious injury have. I'm a little concerned that it is subject to abuse, I think.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker,
I'll throw my motion if you want to make it tougher.
There is a whole scheme with the assault statutes, and I think I gave them to you at the time of the public hearing on this bill, but basically, if you have serious physical injury intentionally caused, then you're talking about a higher grade of offense. And this is fit into the...
it's higher than recklessly, then.
This requires intentional or knowing causing of an injury, not reckless. I can find that.
Mm-hmm.
If you knowingly or intentionally cause serious physical injury as an individual, it is an assault too. So that's a higher grade of offense. And in terms of the statutory scheme, this probably makes sense in terms of placement. It's between the assault four, which is the conduct where it would fit now, or the assault two, which is the serious physical injury, the intentional infliction of serious physical injury.
Okay. Thank you for my comfort level.
Yeah, I've asked Ingrid to look over these statutes really carefully to make sure that we aren't sort of just jerking something out of the air and placing it in place that doesn't, that traditionally it sounds good, but when people are trying to make it work, can take it out of sequence. And so I think, in all fairness, we're probably okay on this. Senator Brockman moves House Bill 2018 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. Let's take 2033 and 2418, the two forfeiture bills, and then we will have taken care of everything that we're up to look at today.
Which would you like to take first?
Well, either one. Which, Ingrid, it's your pleasure.
2418 is easier.
2418 is easier, Ingrid says.
Madam Chairman of the Committee, -1 amendments are being provided to members at this point. This bill was before the committee on May 8th and basically changes the amount of the bond that a claimant is required to file in order to file a claim in a forfeiture case. And the bill would change that from a bond based on the full value of the property to a bond based on the claimant's interest in the property. So it'd be 10% of that person's interest rather than the full value of the property. At the hearing on the bill, there was testimony regarding the fact that there is no direction to the court as to what happens to that bond once the case is resolved. And the committee asked me to discuss a possible disposition of the bond with interested parties, and basically no one could state any reason why the bond should not simply be returned to the claimant at the conclusion of the proceeding. So this amendment would provide that that is what would occur. And as I understand it, it generally does, but some courts are expressing uncertainty as to what should be done.
Okay. The chair would move the dash one amendment. Objections to that? Okay. And we are the little forfeiture bills. We can add it into one.
That bond gets returned on determination regardless of that, which way it's determined. I just want to think that one out. I understand it.
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the reason that was articulated for the filing of a bond is to ensure the good faith of the claimant at the outset. It serves no further function.
If he loses?
The property is seized and forfeited and costs are taken out of the property.
The property is already in the hands of the forfeiting.
That's correct, Senator Shoemaker. And in the other bill that is before you tonight, there is a discussion about returning property to the claimant. However, a procedure is provided in that bill that would permit the court to require some kind of undertaking if that's going to happen, which would be independent of the bond required for the filing of the claim.
When would recourse to the bond be appropriate?
I don't think, Senator Shoemaker, that it ever is. It's simply an obstacle in the way of people filing claims on property they have no real interest in. That's the way it has been explained throughout these proceedings and testimony to the Oversight Committee.
So even if it's a fallacious claim, no recourse to the bond. There can be attorney's fees, I guess, awarded against the claimant, but bond cannot be looked to recover those attorney's fees. It's just some bond.
It's a test. See how bad you want your property back.
And the testimony before the Oversight Committee was that the intention was so that people couldn't just claim, oh, that's my property, even though it was not.
Force of proceeding.
It was a disincentive.
Well, this, you know, we're not living and dying on this bill, I guess.
Yeah, well.
If it has no,
if there's no recourse to the bond, then I can see somebody saying it's a barrier to, it's just a barrier placed in the way of a poor person to making an appropriate claim, and there's no way to justify it because there's no recourse to it.
Okay, but right as we have it now, the bond is what Ingrid, tell us about what happens if we don't pass this bill.
Well, the bond basically will be required.
Question is, it's worse. That's really what I'm saying to you.
Okay.
You know,
good point.
Look at this thing and say, okay, we don't like this. The fact is, either have to change, you have to ask for a amendment, which I'm not complaining about.
No, I see your point. We don't want to remake the whole law here. This is just to kind of ease up on something that may have been overly oppressive, so we'll make it a little less oppressive. All right.
Okay, then, I guess the chair will move House Bill 2418 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as we've amended it. Recognizing that Senator Shoemaker doesn't like the original law and the requirement of the bond at all.
I question it, at least.
Well, that's okay. It's true. It is a barrier. Like, flat out, it says.
Barrier.
And it's used for that purpose.
you want to do about this, Senator Brockman?
Is contraband money in this one, too?
No, we're not asking you to carry it. Who did we do with the contraband money?
Well, I don't know.
No, we didn't give, we gave that one to Hill.
Oh, we did.
We did.
Oh, I don't know.
I
don't care. Go right ahead. It's late. I just wondered what we've done to the bill. I mean, I understood the original.
No, wrong bill.
No, it isn't. Great. Well, then what happened
we
there?
We switched it on
him. Just leave the room and you're in trouble. No, that's fine. I understand that. Oh, I thought we had already done that one. Sure, that's handy. I like that.
Okay. All right. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, now we come to 2033, which has a number of things which we can or can't put in it. We'll see where we go. We have some options, Ingrid.
Madam Chair, 2033 arose out of the Oversight Committee, and the bill deals with the conflict which exists in current law with respect to the issue of whether or not the district attorney can simultaneously handle civil forfeiture cases and related criminal cases. ORS 8.720 prohibits a district attorney from acting as an attorney for either party in a civil action involving substantially the same controversy as a criminal prosecution. And ORS 8.680 authorizes a district attorney to prosecute all penalties and forfeitures incurred in the county. Consequently, this bill would address that dilemma and basically permit district attorneys to handle these, but would require that in order for there to be a negotiated settlement, that the negotiations would have to be initiated by the claimant of the property or the criminal defendant so as to remove the appearance that the district attorney was trying to coerce a favorable civil settlement as the price of a criminal prosecution or vice versa. Dash A2 amendments have been provided to committee members, and these amendments